This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith. Let's go.
They said turn down the sun, cool it down.
Will extreme climate change drive humans towards war? Could wars prevent solutions for climate? Plus the pressing question, what can be done? One of the few people hunting those big answers is a British-Canadian military expert tackling climate. Gwyn Dyer is known in television, radio, and print. His latest of over a dozen books is just out, titled Intervention Earth, Life-Saving Ideas from the World's Climate Engineers. We have reached him in London. Gwyn Dyer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex.
You have a Doctor of Philosophy in Military and Middle Eastern History at King's College London. In a dozen books, you stayed true to military affairs as well as the Middle East, but at some point you added books and articles and a focus on climate change. When and why was that?
Well, the first book I wrote on climate, which was called Climate Wars, the research was done in 2008, mostly, 2007 or 8, because at that point it gradually dawned on me that I was covering all sorts of wars and military confrontations of other sorts, and that's not the biggest problem anymore. The climate is. And so since essentially the reason that I was dealing with nuclear war and stuff, because I thought it was the biggest problem, I kind of naturally added this to the list of things I paid attention to, and eventually I think it's sort of taken over.
And preparing for that book, Climate Wars, you interviewed dozens and dozens of experts about 18 years ago. Now you're back talking with 100 top scientists, young and old, for the new book. Do you find a difference now in their confidence and attitude about the future?
Oh, there's definitely differences. I mean, there's a good deal of denial about the implications of their own science, the science that they are doing themselves, in the climate change community, because you definitely lose points. You might even suffer setbacks if you sound... People will see you as attention-seeking if you actually make too much of a fuss about how bad you think it's going to be. And it's also, there's a general scientific dislike for being alarmist about anything. The scientists I talked to first time, back in the years before the book came out in 2008, had to be pushed, and sometimes wouldn't let themselves be pushed into discussing the kind of conclusions that their own work was giving them, which I wanted to talk about because it did imply wars, it did imply waves of refugees, it did imply famines, it did imply all that stuff, and they didn't want to get into it. There's still reluctance about that, but very much less reluctance. I mean, people have been staring this in the face now, scientists in particular, for quite long careers in some cases, and they've also find it to discuss despair and fight despair, you have to actually acknowledge in much more precise detail what's going to happen and what kinds of handicaps you have trying to fight with people who have the habits, political and social, of human beings, you know? But this would be easy to do if we were dealing with a community of God kings, but they're not. They're sort of descended from the relatives of chimpanzees, and they don't make decisions well in large numbers on difficult topics. So you push them. But they will allow themselves to be pushed a good deal further now than they used to. And in fact, some of them, and I was even in the course of the 3 or 4 years it took me researching this book, I could see this happening. Some of them are migrating from a position of, we will never discuss geoengineering, climate engineering, as the Europeans call it, you know, interfering directly in the climate to hold the temperature down. It was more than your job was worth to talk about that out loud 10 years ago, 5 years ago even. And now they're driven to the conclusion, many, many, many of them, and more all the time, that although they still hate the idea, and frankly, in my view, exaggerate the dangers involved, they will talk about it. And over that 3 or 4 years, I've sort of interviewed people at the start who are going, no, no, devil's work, don't bring it up, you know, get thee from me. And by the end, if you push them up against the wall and threaten them with a knife or something, metaphorically speaking, they will admit that, yes, we do have to think about geoengineering. It's the only way to hold the heat down. If you don't hold the heat down, all of these terrible things will be triggered, feedbacks and then famines and migrations and wars and all the rest of it. So they'll go with you now a lot further than they used to.
Well, I think you'll find it's the same in the climate movement and with climate broadcasters. We don't want to talk about it either, but things are getting pretty hot. And in the 1990s, NASA's James Hansen asked whether Earth could experience runaway warming and perhaps become more like Venus, an atmosphere that he had studied. He concluded there would be no runaway warming on Earth, where the oceans boiled away at least. But you and some of your scientists interviewed now say runaway warming of some kind is possible. What do you mean by that?
But no, I don't mean that, and I'm very careful to say I don't mean that, because it's not that. I mean, we're not going to destroy the planet. We don't have the means. Hopefully, we don't have the inclination either, but we certainly don't have the means. When they are talking about runaway climate now, they're talking about a climate which is being driven mostly by the feedbacks rather than by our emissions, which means we can't turn them off. The major problem threat right now is the feedback. We provide enough heat to trigger some natural process that also provides heat, like melting the ice on the Arctic Ocean and melting the snow cover on the ground around the Arctic Ocean, and that exposes dark land and absorbent oceans, which will take in more heat, and that's a feedback, because it was your heat that created that process, but you can't turn it off again unless you have some way of putting the snow and ice back. So that's a feedback, and there's about a dozen of those that scientists have identified, and they all threaten to hit somewhere between about now. We're just above 1.5 degrees now. We were promised we wouldn't get there until sometime in the late 2030s, but here we are. That's almost all our fault. But when we trigger the feedbacks, it will take us up through 3 degrees higher average global temperature, and conceivably significantly higher than that. But frankly, not much higher than 6 degrees is the consensus view now. So they talk about the scientists who deal with this stuff, and they're a minority who will go big picture and say, this is how bad it could get. The ones who talk about that generally are talking about a world that is, about 6 degrees higher. That's about as high as we could put it if we burned all the fossil fuels that are accessible on the surface. The big mass extermination events, and there's been five of them, I guess. One of them was a freezing event. One of them was an asteroid hitting the planet, the last one. But the other three were all massive 10,000 volcanoes exploding for 10,000 years kinds of things. And that put enough carbon dioxide into the air to give you 14 or 15 degrees higher average global temperature. Now, that will definitely cause a mass extinction, but even that, life survived. It's not Venus. I mean, we're not. What happened to Venus, and it's a great pity, and even possibly involved a mass extermination. No idea what Venus was like before it got very hot, but it's just closer to the sun. It gets more solar radiation. The possibilities for runaway are far higher on Venus than they are on Earth. So when they're talking about it now, and sometimes they do use the word runaway, really they're talking about a world, the better word that some of them use, hothouse Earth. The hothouse Earth is, we lost control, the feedbacks have taken us up to to about 6 degrees higher average global temperature than before the 20th century, say. And that would not even make everybody extinct, you know. I mean, it would just kill 9/10 of the population and maybe destroy our civilization. And there would be a lot of extinctions, of course, but it wouldn't be heat death for the planet. We're either deliberately or just instinctively, we are confusing things in order maybe to frighten ourselves into action. That would be good. But it's not the kind of mass extinction event that we have seen a number of times in the last half billion years.
There seems to be two kinds of geoengineering going around. One of them, we build big machines on the surface of the Earth and we suck out as much CO2 as we can and we store it somewhere. And the other is to actually block out the sun. Solar radiation management would be one example of that. Would you like to talk to us about what you think it would take that would push us in this direction, or are we already going there?
I think we're already going there in the case of what they call carbon dioxide removal, CDR. There are actually plants being built in Texas and Arizona now with U.S. government money or some other money which helps it along from one oil company, Occidental. But carbon dioxide removal is really going to come into its own in 20 or 30 or 40 years when we've got the further putting of emissions into the atmosphere under control. It will never take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere at the speed that we can put it into the atmosphere, the speed that we're doing now, or even half that speed. So really the usefulness of the CDR, the carbon dioxide removal technologies, which basically involves sucking carbon dioxide out of the air and sequestering it underground in mostly exhausted oil fields because the geology will hold it there just like it used to hold the oil there. That's really for getting the carbon dioxide out of the air again once we stop putting it in. Because it's, you know, when you stop putting all the carbon dioxide into the air in 2050 or whatever and hit that magic net zero 50, you don't get back to the old climate. You're stuck, you know, you stop making it worse, but the orthodoxy says that it will just stay at that temperature. Me and a lot of other people think, no, it'll go on rising for a while after that. But that's what it's for, is taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere after you've actually stopped putting it in. So I'm very pleased they're doing this now, because that's technology we will want eventually. I would be very unhappy if we succumbed to the lie the oil industry is trying to tell us, which is, oh, if you've got carbon dioxide removal, then you can go on burning all your fossil fuels. No, you can't do that. So CDR is for the future. I mean, yeah, please do some of the development work now, but don't imagine and certainly don't tell other people that this means we can go on burning fossil fuels. The other thing, the solar radiation management, or that's the original phrase, and now people have found that so embarrassing they're trying to put other SRM words in there instead. I don't care what they call it. We'll call it SRM. That's the whatever word you attach to those initials.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Solar radiation management is about reflecting incoming sunlight, and there's two major ways being talked about, which is putting sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. We know that reflects incoming sunlight because big volcanoes put sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere and the temperature does drop and people don't drop dead, so it's reasonably safe. And another one, which is more regional and certainly a little bit lower tech. I shouldn't say lower tech. The other SRM technique is marine cloud brightening, which basically involves thickening up low-lying clouds over the oceans so that they reflect more incoming sunlight. SRM is all about reflecting incoming sunlight, and that is completely unobjectionable. People do tend to panic about the stratospheric version because it involves putting a nasty chemical in the stratosphere. There's no living things up there, and it doesn't kill living things down here, so I don't think it's that huge an obstacle, but it, you know, it's definitely stepping out of the ordinary. Whereas just thickening clouds up down pretty close to the sea surface, there's a lot of cloud at the level where you could actually spray out a fine mist of water, seawater, containing little granules, tiny granules of salt, and the salt gets in the clouds and becomes a nucleus for condensing more water, and so now you've got more little droplets of water in the cloud, and it's reflecting more incoming sunlight. Very low tech, really, except for the ship that does the spraying. You build little fleets of ships that sail around the ocean, unmanned, satellite-directed, sail-powered, pretty harmless stuff. Either kind of SRM is about actually stopping the heating from affecting the way we live, the crops we grow, the forests, all the BC say wouldn't catch on fire so much, you know, if you were doing a little bit of SRM, that sort of thing. Those two techniques are both, to my mind, quite accessible, reasonably cheap, which is actually important. If it was because the Earth, you wouldn't do it. But it's not that kind of thing. It's existing tech or one-step-up tech, like, you know, you need the right nozzles to do the spraying of very tiny bits of seawater and at the rate of a trillion a second or something. But not a demanding thing technologically, not a demanding thing financially. There are a few experiments with the sea level operation, the marine cloud brightening. Now, there's one going on in Australia where they're trying to figure out whether this could protect the barrier reef. And more recently, there's some American experimenting with it on the west coast of the U.S. There has been no open-air testing of stratospheric aerosol injection, which is the version I was talking about with sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere. We know it's safe because, you know, as I say, volcanoes do it every 30 or 40 years, a big enough explosion to push a lot of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, and nothing particularly bad happens. Maybe it impacts the shrinkage of the ozone hole, the closing of the ozone hole, but I've talked to a number of people who work on that, and they say it might slow it, but it won't stop it or reverse it, the closing. But yet, it's treated as a terribly dangerous experiment with completely unforeseeable, unpredictable consequences. Get thee from me, Satan. Which is ridiculous. I mean, there was a fellow called David Keith, who he got permission from Harvard to do an experiment where he would do he had to go to Sweden to get a government to agree to do some open-air testing of basically how you would distribute the sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere. So it's nitpicking, fine detail stuff. He wasn't even going to use sulfur dioxide. You're going to use a comparable chemical which was not actually nasty, poisonous, whatever. And all he wanted to do was put a balloon up and put a little bit of the other kind, I think it was calcium dioxide that he was going to use, put it into the stratosphere and see if when you spray it out, it clumps up or not, which is a serious technical problem, but it's not actually threatening anything. And it got killed. It got canceled. We do not actually have any record of sulfur dioxide being put into the stratosphere or any comparable chemical just to mimic some of the qualities of the sulfur dioxide. it's treated as treason to do that, which is, you know, the usual human insanity.
Sure, I'm not sure I would call it the usual human insanity, because I have interviewed David Keith, and I've interviewed a lot of other scientists, and some of them are concerned that, well, first of all, humans don't have a good record of interfering with the environment. Everything we do often seems to go wrong. But aside from that, they're concerned about changes to the monsoons, to weather patterns and rainfalls that we're not aware of, and also going down that gilded road where the fossil fuel lobby says, well, see, we've got a solution. We might as well keep burning them and we'll straighten it out later. You've heard all those arguments, I'm sure.
Sure, of course, I've weeded through those arguments, and I don't take them terribly seriously. I mean, frankly, the last time I saw David Keith, he said to me, listen, we don't need to do any more research. If we were willing to go ahead with it, we could go ahead with it right now, talking about stratospheric aerosol injection. But first of all, the worry about you're giving the oil companies an opening, you know? We can't afford to not do this, is my view, because if we don't do this, we're going to hit 3 degrees in the next 20 years, 25 years, in all likelihood, because all the stuff that we're seeing now about, you know, the predictions of, well, 1.5 will stay at 1.5 or below 1.5 until the 2030s. No, we're above 1.5 now, and I don't actually think it was mostly the El Nino that did that, because we're not dropping back, and the El Nino is practically over. But the whole process of doing this does not give you an excuse to go on putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And the idea that the oil companies will seduce us once more and we'll stop doing everything else because we're not going to let it get hotter is ridiculous. I mean, you know, the oil companies seduce us because we want to be lied to. We want to be told that it isn't hard, it isn't going to be dangerous, we can go on with business as usual, or at least with a few tweaks we can do business as usual. They're defending their business model. They should be ashamed. I strongly suspect, retrospectively, when things get really bad, they will go to court about it. They will find themselves in court about it, but that's not going to help anybody if we get that far into deep trouble. But the idea that you mustn't tell the children that we have a potential means of holding the heating down, because they will all be seduced if you tell them that we have that, into burning all the fossil fuel until we take the planet up 6 degrees, seems to me a bit stupid, when in fact we are taking the planet up to 6 degrees. You know, if we go on with this process, I would expect we'd probably and trigger all the feedbacks, which that will do. Predictions do not include the feedbacks. If you include the feedbacks, one of which we may be seeing right now, which is the huge rise in sea surface temperature that there is no explanation for. Scientists are calling it the anomaly. If your sort of default mode, not talking to the public about means of holding the heat down, and counting on cutting emissions as your only method of combating 6 degrees, you're going to get 6 degrees. And so 30 years downstream from the first climate treaty, we have not cut our emissions at all. Not 1 year. They continue to grow. They are twice what they were in 1990. So when you come knocking on my door and offering me this religious belief that only emissions are a fair way of fighting runaway heating and that you must not fiddle with the sunlight, I'm afraid I'm going to shut the door on you. That is suicide. And indeed, we are now seeing many people look at the very rapid warming that we are getting which is way beyond predictions, due to the cleaning up of ship tracks and brown clouds, you know, the pollution-based shield of that is has been reflecting incoming sunlight over big Asian cities in particularly, and over the major shipping tracks in the oceans, and they basically have cleaned that up over the past 15 years so that there's a drastic drop in the amount of stuff in the atmosphere, pollution basically, which has been holding the temperature down because it was reflecting incoming sunlight. Now it's gone, and of course we're getting a bounce back in the, and we're getting accelerated warming from that. And people don't even want to admit that, you know, that you don't mess with the climate only one way. You've got to actually intervene in a variety of ways and balance them, because that's what the climate is doing itself, but it's not doing it with us and me in mind. And so I think you have to take a deep breath and say, no, we are heading for, need to head for, we could do it now, we're not doing it now, we're heading for taking charge of the balance of incoming heat and outcoming heat on this planet, the energy balance, because it involves reflecting incoming sunlight, it involves controlling your emissions in that way of reflecting sunlight, or it may indeed involve putting some kind of screen over the ocean or high in the stratosphere to reflect some of the incoming sunlight. It would be wonderful if one fine day, having done all that, early 22nd century perhaps, or a bit later, we can say, ah, we have restored the balance, we can step back, stop interfering with the climate, stop doing things to reflect incoming sunlight, or stop doing, you know, we stop entirely putting stuff into the planet that into the planet's atmosphere that is causing heating, and now we can just let the natural systems resume the smooth process of managing the surface, managing the Earth's atmosphere and surface temperatures as it did in the good old days. But we, you know, we're not going to get back to there just by cutting our emissions. If we just cut our emissions, then emissions, in fact, will very, very gradually get cut, maybe, though they've never been cut at all in the past 30 years. And we will find ourselves not only with that linear warming from putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere each year, but also feedbacks that we can't turn off, which we trigger with our own warming. That kind of, you know, don't talk about this in front of the children. They'll get the wrong idea, and the oil industry will seduce them, and we'll go on emitting carbon dioxide. For God's sake, we're doing that now. So, you know, try to get the emissions under control, but it's way too late to tell us that you can get away with just getting the emissions under control. As for the dangers, I mean, it seems to me nobody's read the research for the last 10 years, because 10 years ago, when they were doing the work with the climate models, they did find that if you put a given amount of, put an amount of sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere, which is adequate to cancel this year's warming from our own emissions of carbon dioxide, then you do move the rainfall around. And there will be areas that now have rainfall that don't get it and will be very grumpy, and other, probably fewer areas that get rainfall they didn't have now, particularly around the tropics. That was a valid objection, and so they tweaked their models. They worked on it for 3 or 4 years, and now in the community, rather small and beleaguered community that works on stratospheric aerosol injection, they have a different model in which if you only put half the amount of sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere that would be required to cancel all of this year's warming, you don't move the rainfall around. It stays where it is. Okay, so you lost half the effective cooling that you might have got if you could go full speed ahead. but you leave the rainfall where it is, including the monsoons and the whole question of moving the intertropical convergence zone, the band either side of the equator, moving rainfall there north or south and leaving a whole bunch of people stranded in what suddenly becomes desert, has been dealt with. You know, the number of people I hear still quoting the old story is about half of the total climate scientists I've talked to. I mean, you talk to anybody who's working on the stratospheric aerosol injection, and they know we fixed that about 5 years ago in the models. Everybody else still quotes it. I don't know why they don't read the journals.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex talks with journalist Quinn Dyer about his new book, Intervention Earth, Life-Saving Ideas from the World's Climate Engineers.
Well, I just spoke with scientist Wolfgang Kramer, formerly with the Potsdam Institute, now a professor in France, and he thinks attributing the Syrian civil war or the Arab Spring to climate-driven drought sounded good at the time, but fails on deeper inspection of other causes. In his view, we have not seen a war where climate change is the distinctive driver. I'm wondering, as you've been working on this for years, what do you think a future climate war might look like?
I don't actually have a very clear view of that, because my view is more that while there may be climate elements involved and great turbulence and violent clashes and so on, it's very hard to draw up a scenario for a climate war. I mean, I was trying to do that because I thought everybody thought it was likely to be a consequence when I did the first book, and I'm actually less concerned about that than I used to be, which is not to say unconcerned, but it's really hard to draw up a scenario, a plausible scenario, one you can believe yourself at least, in which people go to war over climate. I can almost make one between India and Pakistan, because there's a very peculiar geographical thing there, which is Pakistan depends almost entirely on one big river running through the desert for about 65 or 70% of all its food production, but India controls the headwaters of that river. There's a few others, like the Nile, which are also where the headwaters are controlled from different countries by different countries than downstream, and if it stops raining up in the highlands of Ethiopia, which is where most of the water in the Nile comes from, and the Ethiopians decide they're going to hold on to what they've got because they can't, you know, otherwise their agriculture suffers, the Egyptians would take that very badly, I think. But actual wars over that, wars over water have occurred, but wars over climate is a bit harder to make concrete. I think the bigger source of wars is likely to be waves of refugees or waves of people who are trying to escape the catastrophes that await them and will produce refugees, moving from those countries into other countries. And, of course, that's mostly moving away from the equator, which is where the worst effects will be felt soonest. And so it just sort of compounds the existing migration tendency out of poor countries into rich countries. But it's very hard to get a war out of that. It's you can get huge amounts of human misery out of it. You can get radicalization politically in the sort of host countries or the countries that don't want to be hosts of this migration out of it. But a proper war with, you know, cities being bombed and things like that, I honestly don't think so. One of the reasons I don't think so, and this is a bit crude, the countries that are desperate and whose citizens are trying to get into the rich countries, because that's also the safer countries, at least in the short run, from climate change, are generally also militarily much weaker than the rich countries. So war is not an effective resort for them. and they don't have the means to hit the rich countries safely very hard. The refugee problem is huge. I mean, I'm just waiting. I've been looking at the temperatures in South and Southeast Asia in the past few months. I look at them almost every day. And you're looking at areas right across from Pakistan to the Philippines now. And this is the peak heat season in most of that area, sort of April to June. I went on the weather report from the Indian Meteorological Department for one day, and it was 42 degrees here, 43 degrees here, there, 45 degrees over there, all across northern and central India. Not the far north, not in the Himalayas, but the whole of the Indus Valley, the whole of the Ganges Valley, and all the territory going south from there down to about Karnataka and places like that, two-thirds of India in population or more, is suffering between 42 and 45 degrees, day after day after day. They closed the schools for 2 weeks in Bangladesh because it was too hot for the kids to go to school this spring. So that's where the stuff is going to get bad quickly. And that's where the refugees will be generated. And that's just going to have to be dealt with in various ways. And some of them may be quite ugly in terms of borders slamming shut. And you can shut borders. All you have to do is be willing to kill people trying to cross them, and quickly people stop trying to cross them. But nobody wants to do that, so there's other, you know, desperate searches for other solutions, none of which are very effective. But getting a war out of it? Not really. I've lost a lot of my concern about that. I have bigger concerns, frankly.
And your new book title, it speaks of intervention and of life-saving ideas. Are we talking really about geoengineering, or are there other ideas that you came when you interviewed with your many scientists?
No, I mean, the conclusion I'd reached by the end of the first book, and which I started with already at the beginning of the second book, the one that's just out now, The Intervention Earth, is that we have left it too late, and it was probably inevitable that we would leave it too late to solve this problem with emission reductions or ending emissions, which is really the goal, alone. That is not any longer an option at all. It's not available. Given the demonstration of how slowly we act on these matters politically, you can imagine that we might begin acting a little bit faster or even a whole lot faster once people start to die in large numbers, and particularly as once people start to die from major climate disasters in the developed parts of the world, which is where the changes have to happen in terms of where the emissions are mostly coming from. But I do not see any way that you are going to be able to, let us say, speed up fivefold the rate at which you are cutting emissions. Well, let's be generous. Let's imagine we're cutting emissions now. We're not. But suppose we're cutting emissions at 2% a year now. Be nice, rather than putting 2% more in every year, which is what we're actually doing. How fast are you going to be able to accelerate that? Given that it is human beings, human governments, human political parties, human everything who are making these decisions, how fast are you going to be able to go to 4% or 8% per annum cuts? You know, come on.
What are you doing these days? Are you planning to continue this long work of yours?
I don't see how I could stop. Do you? I mean, it's going to swallow everything else up, this issue. Finally, it's actually getting something like the exposure it should have had 20 years ago in terms of the gap between the research and the public knowledge, or effective public knowledge which might guide sensible decision-making. And I'm a journalist. What else am I going to be doing at this time?
From London, we've been speaking with military expert, author, and longtime journalist Dr. Gwyn Dyer. His television and radio series are legendary. His new book is Intervention Earth, life-saving ideas from the world's climate engineers. Find out more in my show blog at ecoshock.org and check out www.gwyndyer.com. Gwyn, thank you for spending this time with our listeners.
It was a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.